Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, aside from the insurance industry, will the consumers win anything from this health care overhaul?
But first, the Labor Video Project presents San Francisco Hotel Workers Heat Up the New Year. Over 1,400 hotel workers and their community allies demonstrated in downtown San Francisco on January 5th against major hotels corporations' refusal to settle fair contracts. They were joined by Richard Trumka, president of the AFL-CIO, and Unite Here's president John Wilhelm, who along with over 150 union members and community supporters sat down in front of the Hilton Hotel to launch a consumer boycott of the Hilton San Francisco Union Square. The action comes after nearly 5 months of negotiations and street actions, including strikes, in which hotel managements have called for cutbacks, while the workers have been seeking modest increases to sustain health care and retirement benefits. Meanwhile, despite the economic downturn, major hotel companies have continued to prosper.
Since August 14, 2008. We had numerous meetings with the company. Our goal in these negotiations is to win a contract that keeps healthcare affordable for our family, our retirees, and the future of hotel workers. Into five jobs. Yeah. By proposing creating a different tiers, different level of benefit for new hires, and refuse to pay enough money to maintain our medical insurance. Yeah. Brother and sister, if they succeed, this would mean benefit will cut. Family health care coverage will become unaffordable for many workers.
No way in hell!
Your presence here today as a worker, community, elected leader, clergy, and a concerned citizen helping to tell the hotel that when they say take back, we say fight back. When they say cut back, we say
fight back.
There is two ways to this struggle. One is this hotel corporation will have to sign a fair contract, or we will run a boycott and cost them more money than the cost of the contract that they would sign today.
Amen to that. Amen.
Today, January 5th, 2010, we are welcoming the Hilton San Francisco into the Boycott Hall of Fame.
Amen.
Along with the Grand Hyatt, Hyatt Fisherman's Wharf, Sheraton, W Hotel, and the St. Francis.
Amen.
We are boycotting the San Francisco Hilton.
We lean on Local 2 because Local 2 is the best, the strongest, the most militant hotel workers union in North America. we lean on this great community of San Francisco with so many friends and allies and comrades here with us today. Hotel workers need your leadership right here in San Francisco, in Northern California, and throughout the United States and Canada. Hotel workers just like you are fighting for their contracts in 2010 in Toronto, in Vancouver, in Chicago, Honolulu, Monterey, San Jose, Los Angeles, San Diego, throughout North America. Hotel workers are telling the same corporations you work for, no, you are not going to take back what we fought for all these years. And led by Local 2, hotel workers are telling these hotel corporations one thing more, and especially Hyatt. We're saying to these companies, workers in your companies that don't have a union yet have a right to have a union. Workers at the Hyatt on Fisherman's Wharf, they have a right to have a union. The workers in La Meridian, the old Park Hyatt, they have a right to have a union. The workers in the Hyatt in Santa Clara, they have a right to have a union.
More than a single hotel. And it's more than Hilton and Hyatt and Starwoods and International Continental and Marriott and all the hotels in the Bay Area. This is a struggle about 60,000 hotel workers across our country who are fighting for contracts to guarantee good jobs. See, it's a struggle about the freedom of tens of thousands of other hotel workers to make their own choice to join a good union, a great union, and to build a better life. And it is a struggle that we will win! You see, this is a colossal showdown with an industry.
Hoorah!
The hotel industry, which is doing quite well, despite the economy that isn't doing so well. A showdown led by workers who have had their pay and their benefit attacked time and time and time again to fatten corporate profits and CEO salaries. But what's happening here in San Francisco is about more than even that. It's about the struggle of all working women and working men in our country, especially low and middle income wages, to hold on to our rightful share of the American dream. The dream of decent wages, health insurance, pensions, a safe workplace, and some time off to be with our family. It's about the freedom to work hard and be recognized with a good job. A job with respect and dignity and just rewards. And to pursue a better life for ourselves and for our children. You see, for the past years, working families in our country have been hammered by the worst financial meltdown since the Great Depression. Because of corporate greed, millions of jobs have been destroyed. 15 million of our brothers and sisters are out of work, trying to get by on unemployment insurance and food stamps and Medicaid. We bailed out the bankers and the big corporations, but working families are still losing our jobs, our homes, and our dignity. Wall Street is up, but Main Street is down, and that's a national disgrace, and we start putting an end to it by winning struggles just like this one. So we march today. We march today to let Hilton know that we demand respect, that we demand fair wages, that we demand health care, that we demand good jobs, and we'll accept nothing less. And let's remember, this is bigger than the Hilton and bigger than San Francisco. Your fight is the fight of 11.5 million members of the AFL-CIO. Your struggle is the struggle of every working family in our country. When you win, America wins. And win we shall. Standing together, struggling together, fighting together, marching together, trampling out the green in San Francisco together, in California, in every community, in every city in America. Together we shall win.
America of the people, America by the people, America for the people. Which people are you talking about? Are you talking about the wealthy with the means to stay healthy while 47 million go without? No doubt, we need a revolution. It's time for a brand new healthcare solution. Sing it on behalf of the uninsured, because I believe it's so absurd for America, the so-called greatest nation, to be in a healthcare crisis situation.
One day, this nation will rise up.
Justice. Come from the land of milk and honey. But the healthcare industry's addicted to money.
All for one, not one for all.
47 million in dire straits,
excluded by greed and wealth.
So we got to get united in these states
and put the care back in health.
Come on, y'all. Sing healthcare justice for all.
National Nurses United, the largest union of registered nurses, criticized the health care bill passed by the U.S. Senate. They called it tragic and seriously flawed, claiming that it could actually exacerbate the health care crisis and financial insecurity for American families.
They claim it cedes far too much power to the insurance industry. To talk about the legislation, we're joined by Gene Ross, who's the co-president of National Nurses United. Welcome to Building Bridges.
Thank you.
And we're going to be talking about what the legislation, not only the Senate but the House, does for patients' rights. What kind of impact does it have on the patients? There's a lot of talk about this legislation having regulation of the insurance companies, whether they can drop people from the rolls. Is this regulation something that we can count on?
If you want to start with the fact that we were promised health care reform, this truly isn't it. It's been a windfall for the insurance companies, and it's been a windfall for the pharmaceutical industry and for patients. We have lost out. Look in particular at the both bills. They will say that they have put restrictions, that you cannot limit coverage and you can't exclude people for pre-existing conditions. However, there's nothing in there that says there's anything with meat to keep them from doing those kinds of things. For example, you've got provisions in there that still allow insurance companies to more than double charges to employees who fail wellness programs, is what they call them. So say you have diabetes or high blood pressure or another medical condition. Sure, they can't exclude you, but if they can charge more than double what they charge somebody else, how is that affordable for you and how is that fair? They are allowing insurers to sell policies across state lines, and for a lot of people, you might think at face value that sounds like a wonderful idea, because you know somebody in another state who has a better deal than you do. But truthfully, in each state, there are allowances made depending on, oh, for example, who your commissioner of insurance is, how you have insurance set up in that state. Certain states have been very well regulated as to what insurance companies are allowed to do and what they're not. Well, it's going to be a race to the bottom. You will just simply go to the insurance company. We'll set it up in a state that has the fewest restrictions. They'll settle there, and then all policies will emanate from there. Again, that's not reform. They're going to continue to allow insurers to charge 4 times more based on age, plus more for certain conditions. And they can continue to rescind policies for what they call fraud or intentional misrepresentation. That can be something as little as, oh, you didn't tell me you had acne when you were a teenager. Therefore, we're canceling your policy now. You lied. That was fraud. So with all those things being possible in those bills, I don't see how you can call that true reform. And, of course, from the nurses, when we consider reform, we believe that health care is a basic human right for every individual in this country. And it looks like you can either have reform for the insurance companies or reform for us. And it doesn't look like the insurance companies have gotten any reform. It's all aimed at us.
Jean, let's take another aspect of this. I'm in what they would call, and I resent the name tremendously, a Cadillac health plan. Yes. I have Oxford Insurance through my work, and now it's my understanding that there's a confiscatory 40% excise tax on a plan such as that, which some view as a kind of over-the-top plan held only by the very wealthy. But indeed, it's not. If you could break this down for us, because I think that the implications for this tax are really catastrophic for a particular group of people as well, which is very often union workers.
That's exactly right. One of the things we have been able to do when you talk about union benefits is to negotiate, not just for wages, but for benefits like insurance coverage. And when we do, we look at what's feasible for the employee to pay versus what the employer should pay, and also what kind of coverage. So we have limits on things like increasing co-pays every year or even having a co-pay instead of a percentage of the premium, and that's it. Then you don't see anything until you see the bill. So I agree with you. They're not Cadillac plans. They're what health insurance should really contain for every person in this country. And I do know that they have looked at, and I believe it's in there, that some are going to be protected by saying they're going to exclude certain lines of work. Well, if those lines of work are, of course, all male-dominated, mining, construction, police, fire, and so that's not sitting very well with us. And then there are other things in there. It further erodes reproductive choice for women. So, no, we are not happy with this, and we do not consider it health care reform.
Well, getting back to the Cadillac plans also, in the future, more and more plans will fall under that because of inflation.
Exactly.
So that, but I did want to get back to your point about abortion, because that's terribly important at many times, and it's both in the House and the Senate bill. Do you think that that is something that needs to be more forcefully opposed?
Absolutely. And I think we've had several groups come forward, and we're in alignment with them, not the least of which is NOW. You know, the laws that we've had in this country and what they've come to with the previous insurance system, because that's what it is, it's an insurance system, did allow for abortion rights. It wasn't perfect, but it did allow women, didn't matter how much you earned, what kind of an income you had, it did allow you the choice of having an abortion or not. And with the kinds of things that we're seeing coming forward in these bills, it put restrictions on them simply by virtue of the fact that they won't be able to afford it, and that insurance companies can say that is something that is not going to be covered.
Again, the Cadillac plan, we're talking about a tax that would kick in on plans that are roughly somewhere with families that make $23,000 annually and individuals who make $8,500. So, and this would begin, granted, in 2013, but that is very, very low income in the scheme of things, and those plans would be taxed. So I want to delve even deeper into what the implication of that is. So if people don't pay that, of course, that also means that you ratchet down the quality of health care.
Yeah, that's they'll have no choice but to do that because it has been and always will be the bottom line. That's what their incentive is. And we have been working so hard to make sure that when you look at decreasing costs, it comes from the logical place. It's one of the reasons that we are so strongly proponent of a single payer, because money goes out the door when you are looking at all these what I call paper pushers in the middle. You achieve a lot of cost savings when you're not having all that bureaucracy in the middle from these multitude of insurance companies, and you could do it with one insurer, which obviously people get upset because they think it's got to be the government. If you don't save money there, the only place they can continue to take it from is care at the bedside, or if you're in a clinic, direct care, care with the patients. And that means fewer nurses, fewer doctors, fewer nurses' aides, and the people that help us.
There's a lot of concern about the savings that the administration says it can get from Medicare. Now, part of that is the premium plans that they're subletting to the private insurance companies, and that's being cut back, and that will save money, fine. But there's money on top of that that they're trying to get out of Medicare, and they're saying it won't affect the service. Do you have fears about that?
I have fears about all of it, because what we're used to, anybody that works with a union knows this, when you look at the kind of negotiations that take place, you always want to put into your contracts, and this is a contract, it's a contract with the nation, you always want to put something in there with teeth that says this is what you're allowed to do, and if you don't, this is what the penalty will be. And we don't see any of that in either of these bills, not really, nothing with real teeth. So, yes, I believe from what they're saying, the House bill is maybe a little bit better on what you just mentioned. But again, if there isn't something that gives you something that we can see that says, oh, they're going to have to do this because it will be a disincentive if they don't, yes, I would worry about that.
It also would seem that if policyholders have to pay more out of their own pockets, that they'll be more careful, that is to say, more reluctant to access health services. And on the other hand, people with very serious illnesses will be saddled with much higher out-of-pocket expenses and costs.
Yes, and this is just a failure of our whole system. And it's very disheartening to me when I hear people buy into the rhetoric that people are lazy, they don't take insurance when they could, and most of the people could afford it. That isn't what we see as nurses working at the bedside and working with these people. No, there are people who, you know, are extremely poor. It really is a choice between feeding themselves or getting their medication or going to see a physician or a direct care provider. There are people that are in somewhat middle income brackets that still, it's taking up such a huge percentage, or it would, if they could get the insurance that they could afford. They either take a huge high deductible plan or they don't take insurance at all. And to say that, it feels to me as if they're blaming the victims here. Because to say that you would choose to sit in an emergency room for hours, and believe me, it is hours, to get your medical care when you could, as they say, afford an insurance plan and go see a doctor in a clinic and be in and out of there. No, people just are not doing that. They're not getting insurance because they can't.
But a lot of people say that, well, we need to get this plan approved and we can make it better later in the future.
You know, I think they're trying to all soothe us with that kind of logic. And it would be nice, of course, because we're not going to get single payer this time around. I guess we have to be somewhat content with that. But far from believing that this is a way of starting and you can make it better, if you look at it, look what they've done. They've pretty much entrenched the idea that this is the way it has to be in this country. You have to have a for-profit insurance company. You have to have many of them. They can set their own rates. They can do these awful things, which we talked about just a few minutes ago. So if you're saying that going through that first round, we were able to get this, what did we get? We got something that has been in this country for decades. We've got it entrenched now. I think instead of making a spot for us to improve it, it's pretty much set it up so that it's going to make it worse. I think that especially the people on the right are going to continue to downgrade what we already have. And as I said, we're not thrilled with it already.
It would seem that President Obama had jettisoned, to begin with, really, the so-called public option,
right,
which was problematic in and of itself. But, again, just to follow up for a moment on Ken's premise that was put out, and that is that this is monumental. This is the most strategic piece of legislation when it's reconciled the House and the Senate since Social Security. How do you respond to that? How do you respond to the Obama administration saying that?
Well, I wish I'd been there, how that went down. But what I'm told, because I have asked my parents and I have done a lot of reading, what I was told was there was a mandate, a push from the powers that be, FDR, et cetera. And it was, this is what the people have said they want. And I do feel that that's what Obama had campaigned on. We have quotes from him saying so, and I think he's mistaken if he feels the people wouldn't back him up. If he had come forward, and he still could, and say this is where we need to go, I think people would support him.
Well,
but the man said, I want to cover everybody. Truth is, unless you have what's the single-payer system, where everyone's automatically covered, you're probably not going to reach every single individual. And that was our goal, to reach every single individual.
Well, I think we have to listen to the nurses and improve health care. We've been listening to Jean Ross, who is with National Nurses United, and thank you so much.
And onward still to fight for a single-payer system. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.